accession number 27347, reel 15.
Standard brand, reel 15.
Can you run through then the pattern of training? Obviously, how you did it once you'd done your familiarisation. What would be the next steps with the instructor?
Just as with the tiger moth, straight and level, gentle turns, climbing turns, descending turns, then slow climbing turns, then fast climbing turn, slow descending turn, then slow descending, fast descending turn. You learn to do things immaculately, doing them properly, and then speed it up to the point where you make mistakes and learn from your mistakes.
Can you explain to me that with the turns? How do you turn an aircraft like the Harvard?
Well, it depends on the aircraft, but generally, and it doesn't apply necessarily in the Swordfish, with a fast modern monoplane, you can turn and hardly use any rudder at all. You just put the joystick over to one side slowly, and keep the nose level with the horizon as you go around, by using your throttle. But with other aircraft, you have to use a certain amount of rudder. The Swordfish is one of them. And to know how much rudder to use is purely a matter of experience and observation. Because it can vary slightly in different temperature conditions. The fluidity of the air in cold conditions, the air is more solid than in hot tropical conditions where it's attenuated. With the cold air, the aircraft responds more to controls. A small adjustment of a joystick will bring a bigger change in performance in cold air than it will in hot air. Again, it's a question of experience.
Is there a potential problem of stalling while you're turning an aircraft?
Oh, always. When you're distracted from watching all your controls, there's always a danger of stalling. There's also a danger of gaining speed or gaining height. It's coordination between all of them that's the important thing. And unless you are a good coordinator, sooner or later you'll make a mistake in neglecting to watch an important thing at an important time because you're distracted with something else. And it's not until it comes naturally that you begin to lose that danger.
And with the aircraft, before you took off for a flight with the instructor, would you do a preliminary check of the aircraft?
If you didn't, you'd be in trouble. It's no good getting on the climb out from a runway before you realise that your hydraulics aren't working, or that your oil temperature's too high. You've got to do it on the ground while there's still time to do something about it. it isn't quite the same as in a car where your checks don't land you in immediate trouble if you've neglected them. You might be storing up trouble for yourself in a car if you don't check your oil level and your water level and your windscreen washer liquid and so on. But they're not as threatening to life as they are in an aeroplane. Your life depends upon your thoroughness of a check, and the only way to do that is to create a mnemonic, HTMPFF. I mean, it comes naturally to me now after 70, 60 odd years. Hydraulics, trim, mixture, pitch, fuel and flaps. And unless you check every one of them, you'll sooner or later end up in trouble. You'll find that your flaps won't go down, or they won't come up, or they get stuck in one position. That if you take off with your trim in the wrong position and it's nose heavy, you might not be able to clear the boundary. Well, it has fatal effect. No, you've got to have a systematic check on everything.
So how would you do that? Would you check the cockpit details first and then take a walk around the aircraft? Or would you...
Oh, you always walk around your aircraft. Look for obvious things first. And then, with a given type of aircraft, you'd have the same cockpit check. It never vary. You'd always... the same with the walk around... With a given type of aircraft, you'd always check the same things. With the Swordfish, you'd always check that your rocket rails are tight. You wouldn't do it with a Tiger Moth because it has no rocket rail.
Would you walk around with the instructor on the Harvard?
No. No. We always did it separately so that he'd be able to check how observant you were. If I could notice something that he hadn't noticed, or vice versa, it was instructive to both of us, and it was an ability to assess each other to that rapport, whether you had faith or not. If an instructor could fail to notice something that a pupil noticed, this was wonderful marks for the pupil, but humiliating for the instructor. However, it was a wonderful thing for the confidence of the pupil. He'd feel almost that he was beginning to be almost as good as the instructor, which was something.
What about taking off in the Harvard? Could you run me through how you would do that on those Canadian fields in winter?
The big danger, of course, was a slippery runway, that any roughness or cack-handedness, as we called it, with the controls could land you in trouble. For instance, if you were just beginning to open up the throttle and you used too much rudder to keep straight, you could end up by going into the snow banks on one side or the other. one of the big problems with so much power was that as you open up the throttle, you get quite a lot of torque, which tends to take you to one side or the other, depending on the rotation of the engine. And you've got to counter that with generally with rudder. Now, if you do it too roughly, you'll throw the aircraft from the line of flight that you want it to take, and that's not a good thing. And of course, if there are circumstances where you have to abort the takeoff and you close the throttle, but you have forward velocity on the ground, the use of brakes in icy conditions is just as it is on a motorway. If at 70 knots on the motorway, in icy conditions, you are careless with your brake pedals, you end up doing all sorts of wonderful manoeuvres. And it's the same with an aircraft.
What about landing? Was there anything to be aware of landing in those conditions?
Yes. Once again, it's a question of when do you brake. I always made a habit of rolling as long as I could and never using the brakes until I wanted to turn off the runway. In Canadian conditions, use of brakes on an icy runway could only land you in trouble.
How long would it take then for the aircraft from you, say, putting your wheels down to being able to turn off and use the brakes as you were turning off? What would the run be on the runway when landing?
Oh, I forget. I couldn't guess it in feet now. From touchdown, it was just a case of speed. Rather than distance, from losing flying speed, not a question of time, it's distance. I suppose it would be somewhere round about a quarter of a mile, but it's difficult. A lot depends on how icy the runway was, how new the tread on the tyres were. I'm sorry, it's a question that there's really how long's a piece of string.
And at this stage, though, with your landings, I know obviously the RAF and the Fleet Air Arm have really a different form of landing on there. Was there any element of you being taught the kind of three-point landings that the Fleet Air Arm do, or were you purely being taught how to land the
aircraft? Oh, it was always three-point landing, which is the RAF method. The ideal landing is a three-point landing, both in the RAF and the Fleet Air Arm. The only thing is that on a deck landing, you want to be closer to the stall. You want to have your tail wheel lower than your landing wheels, and you want to have your hook down.
So obviously your training's progressing here, and it seems to be following the same pattern in a sense of what you've done with the Tiger Moth, but obviously
yes.
on a monoplane. Were there any other elements that were introduced into that were different from what you'd done with the Tiger Moth?
Oh, yes. We started to get into armaments, of course. We had a camera gun, we could fit a .303 Browning. We could carry practice bombs, smoke bombs. Yes, we had every form of armament training, from shooting at a target, a static target in a sand pit where you could see the sand jump with the spurt of the bullet. We had bombing, we had attacking a towed target on the lake.
Could you take me through how you would do that? How you did the attack, what the method of approach would be and what you were looking for to try and get on the target?
Well, you were looking for a hit on the towed target. And that would be photographed from the shore.
How would you say make your approach to the target, and what would you be aligning up on?
You would try several different approaches. You'd try one which was in line with the direction of progress of the towed target. You also had to practice the aiming off of coming at right angles to the direction of travel of the towed target, and everywhere in between, coming from astern, coming from over the towing vehicle. It was a case of getting used to every angle, because what can't happen with a towed target is it can't change direction suddenly the way a ship can. I would take note of the kick that occurs in the water when the rudder is put over on the towing vehicle, and I'd know that that would follow a little later on the towed vehicle, and you had to guess where the towed vehicle would be. Just as in real life, if attacking an enemy ship, you want the biggest target that you've got, so it would be nice if you came directly at right angles to it. But that ship is going to try avoiding by presenting its smallest profile to the attacker, and it'll either turn away from or towards the attacker. If you're aiming at a target which doesn't know you're there, you'd be aiming off, and the amount of aiming off depended on what you were dropping and the speed of the target. It's a complexity. It's six of one and half a dozen of the other.
Were you using sights in the Harvard then?
For the gunnery, we were using a sight which was projected onto the windscreen, which was very good and rather like the type of sight that was used in those days in Spitfires and Hurricanes. There wasn't much difference between it.
What did it look like, the sight?
It was an orange coloured ring with graticules on it and concentric rings to give you ideas of speed and aiming off.
Did you, when you did the gunnery practice, did you do it against aircraft towed target?
Yes, we did it against towed drogue.
How would you make your approaches to the drug? Would that...
Again, you'd use every approach except right up its backside, because your bullets would be hitting the towing aircraft if you went in from astern. But they preferred you to use a beam-on approach. But practice was also needed in coming in over the towing aircraft, where you had maximum closing speed, where you would have maximum aim off, because you'd have to clear the towing aircraft, but be able to point at the towed target. So you'd have to come in a dive or come up in a climb. My favourite one was to come up at the belly of the thing, because in real life, that's really what would happen. You'd try and get into his underbelly, and you'd be able to do that with the maximum speed, because if you had height above him to start with, you could pick up a terrific speed by going down and coming up under the man's belly.
And how did you do with your gunnery and your bombing practice? What kind of results were you getting?
Well, I got an assessment as above the average for bombing and air gunnery. But it was limited. We didn't get enough practice to learn all the ins and outs of it. I reckon that it was only by operational service that you got the finesse and the polish. We learned basics, and as basics, all right, our judgment accounted for an awful lot. There's some people who couldn't judge how to park a bicycle it's a sort of inborn skill, just like a boy with an air rifle. Some boys can never hit the target. To others it comes naturally.
With some of your fellow trainees, would it be the case that they would sometimes, when doing gunnery or bomber practice, either shoot too early or drop the bomb too early?
Yes, there were occasions of the poor old towing aircraft getting some holes in it. There were occasions where, even though the towing aircraft was at 1,000 feet, that the attacking aircraft would come very close to going into the ground or into the water. Lack of judgment.
At this time, had you also been practicing any sort of aerobatics?
Oh yes, this was an area where the fighter boys came into their own. To me, aerobatics were I suppose like the performance of a trained gang of soldiers or RAF people. I don't know if you saw the British Legion demonstration, where a body of the I'm wandering, my mind's running ahead. On the Festival of Remembrance, they had an RAF regiment display, which was wonderful of timing. Those men acted in a body as if they were all linked together. It was wonderful. A performance that I could never match. To me, that's the aerobatics. The Marine commando in a pool of mud, keeping his gun dry, keeping it out of the grit and the muck, is of a greater skill than the performance of the ground waller who's been trained in a drill. The aerobatics are fine. It teaches you how to handle an aircraft, but it's not the be-and-end-all. To me, the be-and-end-all is performance in the face of the enemy, and that is the technique of getting there, delivering your armament.
What type of aerobatics were they sort of teaching at that level, though?
They taught us slow rolls, barrel rolls, Immelmann turns, looping. You'd never use the loop in a battle with an enemy fast fighter. He'd get you every time. No, it's a different skill. To me, aerobatics is for the show-off, the splendour of flight.
Could you explain to me some of those? What's a slow roll?
A slow roll is where you keep the axis of the aircraft in a straight line. A barrel roll is where you go around off the axis of the straight line. I'm sorry, it's hard to explain.
Is it off the axis of the thing, but obviously in the shape of a barrel?
Yes. There's an element of climb in it, and an element of descent in it. All about the one axis of flight, but away from it. There's a certain amount of centrifugal force to it, whereas a slow roll, there's no centrifugal force. You're just rotating.
And you mentioned there the Immelmann turn. What was that?
It's a half loop and a roll off the top. It's a way of gaining height. And reversing direction, mainly reversing direction. You don't gain a lot of height in it. You would have gained more height in purely opening your engine and climbing.
Am I right in thinking it's named, obviously, from the German ace Immelmann? Was that a way of getting onto the tail of another, reversing flight and getting onto the tail of another aircraft?
Or getting away from somebody, rather than getting on the tail of somebody.